Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. I am here with Christian Hunt of Human Risk. How are you doing, Christian?
I'm doing very well, sir.
So I met you on LinkedIn, and I think you have a really interesting, not only an interesting business, but an interesting approach to this broad conversation that we've been trying to have with the ethics and compliance game. And I've been excited to get you on just to kind of hear how you look at the world. And I think your approach bridges a really important gap. So why don't we just jump in? Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you got to where you're at with Human Risk?
Sure. So I'm kind of an accidental regulator and accidental compliance officer. I don't think anyone ever sets out with that in mind. But I started my career in financial services in London. And post-crisis, the regulator were looking for people that might think slightly differently that weren't typical regulators. So I came in with this kind of mandate of changing the way that banks were supervised, recognizing that they'd got certain things wrong in the crisis. And I joined as an international banking supervisor. So I had a portfolio of international banks that I was responsible for looking at. And I spent most of my time as a regulator looking at UBS, which is one of the sort of firms in the UK. One of the larger footprints in the UK. And so any listeners who have worked in regulation will know that if a regulator is spending a lot of time looking at a firm, that is not necessarily good news. And so I spent a lot of time looking at them, solving problems. One of the issues I had to deal with was there was a rogue trader who almost took the firm down. His handiwork became known 7 days after I'd taken my roll up. So there were a lot of big issues I was kind of having to deal with. And so I spent a few years at the regulator, largely looking at UBS. And so it was the logical place for me to go once I came to leave the regulator. I had a stint as COO at the regulator as well. And then I joined UBS in a risk and compliance role. And what I started to realize was that the way that UBS and other firms were approaching risk and compliance was really kind of missing the point of what the discipline was about. And that point was kind of resonated to me was there was a lot of things that we were asking the audience to do, asking the employees to do. What happened was a lot of emails would be sent out by me to a subset of the audience. And of course I would get those as well. And I started to recognize I was being sent on training courses and e-learning that I didn't really enjoy. There were lots of policies and procedures I thought weren't necessarily as effective as they could be.
Right.
And what I started to realize was that compliance was the business of influencing human decision-making because organizations can't be compliant of their own accord. It's the people within it that determine that. So if you want a compliant organization, you need to have the individuals doing the right thing. And then by default, the organization will be compliant. And so that plus my second discipline of operational risk, which for people not in banking is non-financial risks, all the risks associated with banking that aren't to do with the finance side. That discipline was also about influencing human decision-making because people were the biggest cause of things going wrong, either starting the problem or making it worse. So as I put all that together, I realized I was in the business of influencing human decision-making. And we were going about it as the rest of the industry was in a manner that looked very good on paper, but didn't really resonate. And so began this adventure in bringing science to compliance, which is looking at using behavioral science, i.e. the art of understanding the drivers of human decision-making, to infuse how you go about doing compliance. So you can get people to do what you want if you really understand the motivations and the drivers of their decision-making. And so that was the journey I started there. I created a behavioral science function within the firm to do that. And then about a year and a bit ago, I took the show on the road. And so what Human Risk does now is the same thing I was doing inside the firm, looking at how you deploy behavioral science to influence people to get the outcomes that you're looking for, whether it's in compliance or whether it's risk or whether it's some other aspect of the firm's objectives.
So when you were in UBS and you started this behavioral science kind of department or function, can you tell us about what that looked like, what the mandates of that function were, and what some interesting findings you had on your path toward human risk?
Sure. So the key piece really was that I'd started to do some of these things within the world that I controlled. So I was responsible for covering one of the businesses in one of the global regions. And so I'd been running various experiments there, really starting with simple analysis of saying, which policies are people breaching the most often? Where are we getting the biggest number of complaints? And those are useful pieces of feedback, because you can say, look, if you've got one or two people breaching a policy, then there may be something wrong with those people. You've got a people problem. If you have hundreds of people breaching a policy or not doing what you want, that kind of suggests there's something wrong with the policy or the thing you want them to do. And so an example might be, you may have a policy that's badly worded. You may have a policy where the training is terrible. Maybe you're monitoring the wrong thing. Maybe it stops something legitimate from happening. Maybe it's just really hard to comply. And so this feedback that you get from your target audience, from your population, can tell you quite a bit. And so one of the key bits that I was looking at really is saying, look, many of the times when we record compliance breaches, it's not actually people setting out to willfully break the rules. It's there is something on the way that impedes them. Maybe it's a misunderstanding. Maybe it's really complicated. Maybe they've got a conflicting thing, which is their boss says, make as much money as you can. And in order to do that, you have to cut some corners. And you want to keep your job, so you're cutting. So looking at the real drivers of behavior starts to get you some interesting clues. And the challenge that I think often you find in organizations is that you'll look at it and say, people have breached a rule, bad person. I look at it the other way and say, if it's lots of people breaching it, bad rule, and we should look at those pieces. So looking for patterns of lots of people not doing what you want is illustrative, not necessarily, I mean, clearly there are situations where it is a population deciding not to do it. But generally speaking, people want to do the right thing. There's something wrong with the architecture, and you can start to unpick that. And so that's a really helpful start point as to identifying things that you can use behavioral science effectively with.
So it's kind of a process of, you know, where are my risk pockets? Where kind of scientifically, where are some indications that there may be an issue? And then sort of double clicking on that or diving into that, to that potential area and trying to diagnose the root cause of these violations. And it sounds like what you would say is to have a bias toward, well, let's make sure the rule is written right before we just automatically assume the rule is written right and we just start kind of demonizing the people.
Yeah, so I look at it a little bit like you would look at marketing or any other attempt to influence human decision-making or behavior. Now, you wouldn't launch an advertising campaign on a big scale without testing it to say, does this actually work the way you think it works? Does it? Whereas compliance regulations and requirements, which is the same thing, it's just in a different context, never go through that level of scrutiny. And it's, you know, nobody gives any great thought to how does this come across. It's let's launch something that looks defensible. You know, if we want to cover ourselves, we write the longest possible policy. Right? That, from a theoretical perspective, covers you. From a practical perspective, if you're asking people to wade through ridiculously long policies, they don't do it. You know, my favorite example from kind of quote unquote the real world is if you think about when you download an app. iTunes is always the one I refer to, right? There's this time where you technically read the terms and conditions and you click the box.
Yeah, and
does anybody ever do that?
You attest to having read him.
Right, right. And so we know intuitively that when that is presented to us, we kind of switch off and we just go, and of course I can't negotiate with Apple, right? I have no choice. So if I want to use this thing, I click, 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 and I presume it's kind of going to be okay. And we do that in that context. In a work environment, again, we shouldn't expect people to wade through. If we wouldn't expect a customer to do it, we shouldn't expect our employees to do it. And so this mindset that I'm trying to bring is to say, look, if you want people to do something, then think about how you can make it easy for them. Think about how you can engage it. And there are lovely contexts that you can pick from outside that you can then just think about, well, how would this play out if this were a customer situation or if I were, you know, engaged with if I were trying to buy a product of a company and they made me do this, how would that make me feel?
So I love
if you start with that mindset, you suddenly realize that a heck of a lot of things that are imposed on people rely on the fact that you're employing them and that somehow you have the ability to overturn normal human interactions because they're an employee.
Yeah, that there's some, you know, implied authoritarian relationship where they're just going to do what they're told. When to your point, we're all kind of free agents, acting in our own sort of free will and responding to whatever incentives are in the marketplace. You know, something you said just now, which I think is totally spot on, is this connection, this corollary that you drew to marketing. Marketing's entire angle is to try to drive some human behavior, human being a potential client, to engage with your firm. And something we've been talking a lot about lately is that, you know, marketing is really trying to talk about your brand and get that sort of reputation out in the marketplace. And that's where historically there has been so much budget spend and so much attention given to that sort of outward brand. What we're talking about now, as we get into this compliance 3.0 chapter, which you're kind of part and parcel with, you're kind of foundational, you know, you're speaking to the foundation of what this sort of more humanized approach is. I think you can start to realize that your brand is just one thing. Your external brand and your internal brand are just different sides of the same coin.
Right. And
the transparency that is inherent to today's economy has caused the veil between the internal and external brand to be pierced to the point where it might not even exist at all anymore. I kind of say that it doesn't. But my point is, when you can start to look at it from that angle and you can start to see that, okay, all this effort that I'm spending from a marketing standpoint is trying to drive behavior, I need to take that same framework internally if I'm trying to change behaviors internally. It then not only unlocks a ton of potential, you know, what I call kind of risk management, or you know, kind of like crowdsourcing risk management. It not only unlocks the potential for that, but it now allows the effort that we're placing on our compliance program to get more traction more quickly, because we're treating the people like people. What my question to you is, why has this taken so long, do you think, to get into the equation? To me, this is like the linchpin. This is what allows this equation to actually work. This takes these words off a page and starts to influence behavior. Why has this, and again, you know, I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but like, people in compliance are not idiots. Like, they're very smart people. Why has this connection to the human element not been made in the last, you know, 20, 25 years?
It's a great question. And, you know, I ask myself, and then I go, look, it took quite a lot for me to make that shift and to actually want to implement this. And the reasons I was able to do that was I was covering a business within the firm, which was the asset management business. And that business was sort of, you know, nothing had gone wrong in that business. It sat there. And so there were problems elsewhere within the firm. And so whenever things were implemented, the asset management business wasn't the first thing people thought of. It was kind of the last thing. So I would say I was in a position where if things weren't going to fit, and there were plenty of policies that made sense in one context that were put across the firm as a whole that didn't necessarily make sense in that context. So I had a kind of localized example of stuff that was happening where there were some extremities that highlighted it to me. I also was very attuned to the challenges because a lot of stuff was being done in my name. And so I felt like the proverbial protester outside the White House, where emails would go outside my name and I'd be holding the "not in my name" banner.
Right.
Because when emails are sent out in your name and people know you're approachable, they're going to come around to you and go, what the hell is this policy? What is this thing you're sending me on? And I, after a while, I didn't have good answers because stuff was coming out of the machine that you know, I just didn't recognize. And stuff, to be fair, stuff also that I was putting out also wasn't attuned to it. And I suddenly realized that I had that I was in the business of influencing human decision making. And I had the background at the regulator to know where this stuff was coming from so that I could, one, feel confident that I was covering what they wanted, but two, that I could make that argument internally, so that people who were steeped in traditional methods of doing things couldn't kind of outflank me on that.
Yeah.
So I think I had a very unusual set of circumstances that made me realize this piece and gave me the courage to challenge it. If you're somebody that hasn't had those sort of moments of enlightenment, then it's very, very tough to do that because it does, you know, the traditional methods are defensible. Put stuff in a policy, send every single employee on training that may or may not be relevant just in case. All feels safe and defensible. So from a kind of political perspective, it's a smart thing to do because you can say to the regulator, everybody's been sent on this training, everybody's read these policies. And of course the regulator likes this because it sort of feels like it's ticking boxes. But what we know in reality is it doesn't work. And I think the challenge that everybody has is if you ask them, they would love to do it differently. But there isn't necessarily that political courage or ability to do it. And so it becomes an overturn. But what I find fascinating is when you try and tell people to adopt these new techniques is you often get an argument that is sort of, well, you need to prove to us this stuff works. You know, where's the science behind this? Where's the evidence behind it? And there is some science and evidence behind it. But what's really interesting is that same logic isn't applied to the traditional methods. So nobody ever says, I can justify what I'm doing now by dint of science. They go, that's the way we do things. If you want me to change, you have to come with a huge amount of justification that I don't use for my existing piece. So I think we're at a really interesting tipping point. And, you know, COVID, and we can come on and talk about this if you want, is a really good illustration of, you know, when traditional methods work well and when they work less well.
Right. So it's so interesting that in order for you to have this light bulb turned on, you had to be in this really unique position, this really unique hybrid position where you're sort of firsthand, not only in a spot where you have sort of downloaded the regulator's mentality and had the nuanced experience of sort of sitting in those shoes or sitting in that seat. And then also on the other hand, having the nuanced frontline sort of operational exposure for you to see like, okay, there's a chasm here between what's actually happening and what's intended to happen. So good on you for kind of, you know, stepping up and saying like, wow, I really need to build a bridge across this. Because to your point, at the end of the day, it's all well and good to have a 20-page, you know, code of conduct, but if no one's following it and it's all written from a defensibility perspective without any consideration for the human element, then, you know, you're just going to be kind of where you're at. Why do you think it's so hard for people to bridge that gap without having actually, you know, without having been in that sort of hybrid position?
Well, look, the traditional approach to stuff is easier, right? Because I don't have to think, I roll it out, I can feel comfortable doing it. And so you see this with policies is my favorite example. You know, these things just get longer and longer and longer because I add more stuff. And I can sleep well at night because I have codified the world to a, you know, to some 500 pages worth of stuff, and it's all in there and we're covered. And of course, you theoretically, as you say, you theoretically are from a legal perspective. I question, by the way, whether that would actually stand up in court, because I have visions of the judge going something like, ah, so Mr. or Mrs. CEO, you wanna basically claim against this individual, you wanna fire this individual because they failed to read your policy. And you say that everybody's read, what does it say on page 67? Right? Because you have also claimed to attest it. And so I don't think it would necessarily stand up in court, but I think it feels sensible and it feels logical. And you know, I think that unless you've had it tested, right, unless something has gone wrong, then it's very easy to kind of hide behind that thing and say, well, you know, it's okay, it's good, it's logical, it's sensible, it works well, and it's got the legal mindset says it's okay. Right. What I think is really interesting and where we're starting to see failures is where you have a world that is not codifiable. So if I take a topic like ethics, okay, it's really easy to say something like do the right thing, right? So the Google do no evil or whatever that thing. Really easy to say that. But in practice, what does that mean? Because what, you know, one context can be different to another context. And so codifying that starts to get really difficult. And if you over codify something like that, you will end up with unintended consequences because people will apply it in times that you haven't contemplated.
Correct.
And so if there is a qualitative element to compliance, i.e. we need the individual to be engaged and be thinking for themselves and thinking about the context and the nature of it, then codifying it is really dangerous because actually you don't allow people to step outside when it would be right to do so. And you also give people this perfect defense for doing the wrong thing. And so, you know, if you think about the idea of regulatory or compliance arbitrage, you know, that you can only arb something where you've got a sort of codifiable, you know, there's a set of rules here, and then I can see reality allows me to do something that the rules didn't contemplate or that the rules miscaptured. And in a world that is constantly changing, we're seeing lots and lots and lots of examples where codifying things is highly dangerous. And if you want people to be engaged and people think for themselves, if you have treated them like robots that are just programmed to do stuff and you've incentivized them to do that, they will not do the things that you need them to when it gets really bad. And so to your point around you know, risk management within organizations, I think it's really interesting because if you want to be ahead of the 21st century risks, and whether that's some of the social trends, the technological, you need everybody within the organization to be able and willing to put their hand up and say, I think there's a problem here. And typically what I found as a regulator, but also now working with clients, is when something goes wrong, somebody somewhere knew. They might not have known the full extent of where it was going, but they had an inkling. And if you could have tapped that early enough and could have made them come forward, you would have been able to catch it.
Right.
So often these ideas about sort of things blindsiding organizations is just not true. It blindsides the C-suite, yes, because they haven't tapped into that collective piece. Now, the only way that you can tap into that is create structures that incentivize people to come forward, that gives people the knowledge and security that you're going to take them seriously, that you're going to follow it up, that you're not going to blame them if they've identified something.
Right.
And the more you have a kind of arcane, codified kind of set of rules that you want people to follow slavishly, the less likely they are to be human and be intelligent and responsive, because they'll go, I'm incentivizing this organization to strictly follow procedure.
Right.
And so it's a case of balancing those things. Now, there are some contexts in which you do want people to follow behaviors, codified behavior strictly. A nuclear power plant is a good example of a situation. I don't want someone going, I wonder what happens if I press this button, or let me just change the mix in the reactor. So there, food safety is another one, right? There are examples where you want people to slavishly follow rules, and it's reasonable. The problem comes, I think, is that a lot of the things that we're asking people to do from a compliance perspective don't sit neatly in that codifiable space. So if you can codify it, do. But if you can't, think intelligently around it. And so what I'm saying to people here is we need to think behaviorally about when do these things make sense. And you cannot treat all risks and all rules as if they are the same. There are different risk profiles attached with them. So, you know, saying we have zero tolerance for any rule breaches, really dangerous, because there are some rules that are minor. You don't want people to breach them. It's not consequential. There are others where you absolutely don't. And so we need to think about these things and flex and treat people like they're adults. And that for me is the biggest thing. We don't do that.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. People kind of give you what you ask of them in a way. So if you're going to treat them, you know, it's like your kids. Your kids will give you what you expect of them. If you treat your team, you know, like to your point, robots, well, then they're only going to follow that on a very sort of subhuman level. And they're just going to be sort of automatons following those rules. If we can give them the principle, it sounds like what you're saying is kind of more of a principle-based policy, something that kind of talks more about the principles that kind of are overarching the policy and trying to build some common sense into it so that you can treat people like adults versus giving them 20 pages of examples for something that's very simple or something like that.
Yeah, so I think there are some things where, as I say, you just want people to just do exactly what's required. So if there are, you know, electricity is involved, or food, you know, there are processes, and you can there you can say to people, I will lay it out, and I do not want you to deviate from this. Don't get creative around this. This is totally. But there's a whole load of other things where it's important for people to be reactive to the situation, to understand the nuance of it, to think about it. You know, it's the same thing when if you phone up a company and the operator you speak to is literally just giving you slavish, not answering your question, is just literally reading the standard response. That feels really irritating and disengaging. So what I think one needs to do is to be thinking, that's why I said talk about other contexts and saying, think about, you know, those interhuman. So there's going to be times where all people need is just a detailed checklist that they need to follow, right? To give them the checklist, and if they follow this, they're okay. There are other times where you need them to use their initiative. And what you, I think, have to work out is to say, when is it people need help? So if the common sense answer is the right one, don't spend a massive amount of time on that, because you just free people, allow them to use their common sense, you'll get the right outcome. If there are things that are not obvious, then you probably need to help and guide people there, because it's not reasonable to. So there's sometimes where you need people to do things that might seem counterintuitive in the moment.
Okay.
Do that. So particularly where you've got some, so there's certain regulations, notably in financial services, where you're not allowed to do certain things and there's a good reason for it, but common sense would tell you you could.
Right.
And so there you might need to help it. But I think the biggest challenge is what we spend a lot of time doing is helping people understand the black and the white, when actually the bit they need help with is the gray.
Yeah.
So, you know, the number of times I've seen sort of training courses where they did we will have a scenario and you create this extreme scenario that's so ludicrous,
right,
that people kind of go, I don't need help with that. What I need help with is the nuance part. And yet, you know, and so banking, great example, is you everybody sent on anti-money laundering training, very important part of the industry. But often the scenarios you get is so-and-so has turned up and his sister has showed up with a briefcase full of money. Now, anybody that's working in the industry is going to go, that seems a bit suspicious. I will be on, you know, I'm going to be alert here. I'm going to pay attention. But that's the scenario. That's not the complicated situation people need help with. It's the sort of more suspicious things. You know, if somebody is behaving in a strange way, here are some indicators of the sorts of things to look out for, but that's not an exhaustive list, then think about getting some help. So help them through that thing. But very often, again, it's nice and convenient if you run people through the equivalent of the do not murder course. You know, we all know that murder is a bad thing, so we don't need to spend time on that. Let's spend time with people on how do they handle situations that they are likely to come across where them using their common sense might not get you to the right outcome.
So when you come into a business or you come into an organization, where, like, what is your process like? Like, are you first trying to diagnose who, like the people in the room, how they look at this stuff and the extent of, you know, new scientific evidence you're going to need to incorporate in your discussion in order to get them persuaded to your side of the fence? Or are you more just straight diving into straight data and saying, okay, which policies have violated first? Like, what's your kind of approach in on your own persuasion path to get people to turn these light bulbs on? What impediments do you find yourself running into? Like, what gaps in their mental frameworks do you consistently see?
Right. So I think the first thing to say is that I will typically only work with firms where there is someone senior that gets it, by which I mean they either have recognized that what's going on within their organization isn't fit for purpose, doesn't feel fit for purpose, is potentially costing a lot of money and not getting the results they want, or where they've had a blow up, something has gone wrong, you know, they have to face facts that something undesirable happened, or they've seen something undesirable happen elsewhere, maybe an incident at a competitor where you kind of go, that could have happened here. So if I don't have a senior person who's on board already, it's very difficult to implement this stuff because it does go against conventional thinking. And conventional thinking, not invented here, massive obstacle to doing some of these things, particularly when the people you're speaking to are the people that have created the system or who feel like their job is dependent on the process that's in place. So I need that kind of level of support and buy-in to be able to do that. And it has to come at a senior level because, you know, there are some very counterintuitive things that I will propose. For example, scrapping certain controls. So there are lots of controls within organizations that look good on paper that psychologically are useless. So an example would be if I have to run, you know, within banking, there used to be a thing where marketing materials need to be approved by compliance. Sounds really sensible and logical until you look at it and say, what does that incentivize the people who are producing the marketing materials to do? The answer is push the envelope. And actually what's interesting about compliance reviewing marketing materials is that they can see what you've done, errors of commission. They can't see errors of omission, i.e. what you haven't said. So if financial services products, very important that you disclose how products will perform in certain circumstances. Now, a compliance person won't know that under certain market conditions, this particular product might do something crazy. So there's an example of a control that purports to be really good. I've had someone else look at it. But actually that person that's looking at it can't give you a full guarantee on it. And you have incentivized the person preparing the materials to go, I'm going to push the envelope here. So that control sounds good on paper. And we know from examples in the US Navy, they've cut back on controls because they know that if you think somebody else is going to do it, you won't do it. And if everybody thinks somebody else is doing it, then you know, you have a problem. And so there's lots of examples like that where we're asking for counter, you know, I'm scrapping things and replacing them with stuff that feels less safe, but intuitively isn't. So I have to have people that are on board.
So I just find that so interesting. Like, as you were talking about that, I was thinking that the people who have resistance to this, the main sort of protection, like there's some risk, right? A part of the equation is some policy that supposedly influences some behavior mm-hmm. to prevent this risk from happening. But what they're truly relying on, it seems like they're really relying on the defensibility in a court scenario. So almost inherent to their approach to looking at what you're bringing to the organization or to this question, inherent to that is a protection. It's almost an assumption that, like, well, people probably aren't going to follow it, but if they don't follow it and this ends up in court, worst case scenario, if it ends up in court, then really all I have to hang my hat on is this document. And I better make sure that this document, to your point, has all the stuff and looks sort of passable from a judge's perspective. But I think the broader issue here is, like, the name of the game is not, losing a court case. The name of the game is not even winding up in court. So the only right. way, so then you need to hang your hat, not on the document itself, but on the behavior, to your point, that is being evoked from the people in the organization. That
Yeah, it's classic substance versus form.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and so we focus very much on the form of things. And we say, does this look good? And I, you know, if you want a really good example, for those of your listeners that have traveled frequently, you go to some countries and they ask you questions, you know, as part of the immigration process that are frankly idiotic. So my absolute favorite one, right, comes from your country, where you get asked, you know, are you, and I'm paraphrasing here hugely, but are you coming here to commit acts of terror?
Nope.
Right. And you sort of sit there and think, like, what is the point of that question? Because nobody is going to sit there and go, well, I was, but now that you've asked me, I better disclose it to you because I wasn't going to tell you, but I will now. Right. And all you end up with is and this is where I can criticize my own country. There was a lady here in the UK who accidentally ticked the wrong box and is now barred from ever traveling to the US again because you're on that list. Man. What you're going to catch with that is...
What person on the list? Her.
Well, probably, yeah. Or yeah, there's bound to be a few other cases of not. I mean, you might argue and say, look, is literacy an entry requirement?
But
there's an example. It's a silly process that sort of is technically defensible, and you can imagine that whoever designed the form would say, well, look, we've screened that out. Now, maybe there's a really sophisticated process behind it that's designed to see, you know, as they go through, maybe they look you in the eye and they ask you and just ask you to confirm again, and there's some really sophisticated behavioral analysis. I doubt it. I suspect those forms get put in a box somewhere and ignored. And actually what you've done in a way is you've sort of created additional bureaucracy that gives a pretense of comfort that doesn't achieve anything whatsoever in terms of looking at the substance of the risk. And I think, you know, that there's billions being spent globally on processes and controls that do absolutely nothing. And in fact, in worst case, can have the opposite effect, which is, you know, back to my passport form, you could take an approach of going, these are dumb questions. I'm going to treat this with the contempt it deserves. So if I get stopped by someone and ask some questions, you know, I'm going to treat that. So it doesn't leave anyone having a great amount of respect for the authority that has produced that. And I would argue in a compliance context, you are up against the world's worst piece of branding. Who the hell came up with the word compliance? I mean, that branding is shocking. And then you add the suffix officer and you make it even worse. Now, where else do you add the suffix officer and it makes the situation worse? Nowhere. And so I look at it and say, that doesn't help you. And you are naturally perceived to be a restrictive force. If you then try and engage with your target population in a manner that doesn't speak to the realities of their lives and it feels like a burden, then you're not going to be connecting with them. They're not going to engage with you honestly and transparently, back to your point around stopping and going to court. And you want people to have an open and honest conversation with you. And so treating them like they're idiots or people who can have their time wasted or people who have nothing better to do but fill compliance forms, then you're not going to get the outcomes that you want. And what kills me about this is we all intuitively know this.
Right.
And that's the battle and the challenge that I've got, which is I think if you can open people's eyes by highlighting alternative scenarios where that same dynamic is unacceptable and there's an alternative solution, then I think we can start to win this thing over. And I see a lot of people, if they're honest, recognizing that they need to change things because it's not working, particularly where if you look at COVID, we've got different work patterns, we've got different dynamics, we've got cost-cutting pressures. This is a great opportunity to change the way we do things. So I'm really hopeful that as we start, you know, and thank you for having me on the podcast because it's another helpful place to speak out about this stuff. I'm not doing this. I'm on this mission because I recognize it as a problem, and so sure, I want to make sure that I can, you know, I can feed myself and so. But bottom line is, I believe in this because I really think compliance needs an overhaul, and we can make this happen relatively easy with small steps that'll make everybody happier and we'll get better outcomes.
So it's just so interesting to me, like, when you were describing this compliance issue, it's almost like a self-awareness problem within the compliance function. The way that we've named ourselves, the way that we interact with other parts of the business, we know that these shackles on ourselves are a pain in the neck and they make our lives easier, but then we kind of pay it forward, so to speak, and create those same shackles for others. What do you think the root of that sort of, for lack of a better term, the lack of self-awareness within this function is? Like, what is that?
So look, I think that is definitely part of the problem, but let's go broader than that, because I think it's not just compliance's fault. I think you can put some of the blame at regulators. So the word compliance, you've got loads of regulators insist that you have a function called compliance. So that doesn't help you. And lots of regulatory requirements are just as bad in the way that they're executed. So you've got regulators doing the same thing to the industry they regulate. And why are regulators doing that? I'll criticize them on the one hand, but I'll also cut them some slack because they've got pressure from politicians. And so laws get passed that require regulators to do things. They behave in a manner that discharges that mandate. They're only human. And so you get this sort of, you know, kind of cascade of challenge down, if you like, that makes that a little bit more difficult. So, and then look at within the business and you say, look, historically, the reason, if you asked many people in the business, why do we have a compliance function? The answer is they are there to make sure we are compliant. Correct. Now, how do I think about that? I think about that the same way that I might think about other things where I bring someone in to deal with the problem. So the reason we have an IT function is I don't want every single person in the organization to have to be an IT expert. I have a security function to deal with security. So the average person doesn't have to think about locking the door at night. That's covered by a function. And if you take that mindset, you could say, well, compliance are there to deal. They should just get on with this stuff and don't darken my door. I'm here to make money. They're here to cover the... And of course, the nature of compliance as a task is that you can't do it on your own. Right. And you know, even the best, most sort of able compliance, because it's down to individuals and you can't be in every single meeting and every single moment and part of every single decision making. But there's a misunderstanding around that, that, yeah, sure, compliance is allowed to perpetuate. But I think everything, it needs a reframe and a recalibrate. Now, I think that can be done in terms of compliance has to make the first step. Right, because this becomes a little bit of a dance, right? Somebody has to go first. So I think if compliance would approach this thing and say, look, we can do things differently, the business will lap this up if you help them understand what's there. And you say to them, look, we want to make it easier for you guys to do the right thing. So we're going to work with you. That requires you to make some changes, but we'll make some changes as well. You can then have that discussion with the regulator, who, by the way, biggest excuse that people come up with for not doing things I'm talking about is the regulator won't like it. Not true, but you have to communicate it to them in the way that says, we're not doing this because it's going to save us money or because it's going to allow us to cut corners or because whatever. You know, it needs to be framed as we are going to get better outcomes. And often the way that's communicated to regulators is terrible. It's kind of like we've scrapped the following 20 controls and we've made less people doing the training. I mean, that sounds awful unless you can explain the backdrop and the background behind it, which is why this needs a little bit of understanding of the behavioral science. It needs a clear narrative internally to help compliance officers communicate how they're doing and think about what they're doing. It needs the people that are paying the bill for this ultimately, the business. And so there's a whole host of challenges with this piece. So I wouldn't just, back to your question, I wouldn't just blame compliance on its own. But if we want to get out of this situation, compliance is where it starts. Now, my optimal piece would be if you could find CEOs and say to them, look, we can deliver something here that will save you money, make it easier and get you better outcomes. If you were in the sales business or in the R&D business and you came with that narrative, they will be throwing themselves. They go for it. Well, let's do that. Compliance needs to have the same dialogue, which is you are currently spending a whole load of money and through a combination of factors, we're not getting the outcomes that we ought to be getting. We can find ways to make this better and to help future-proof it as well. Because that's the key piece here, is we need to build frameworks that are flexible, particularly in a world of uncertainty. We need flexible frameworks that can respond to changing circumstances. That doesn't mean lowering of standards. That just means being responsive and real to the changes in the world.
Yeah, there's this concept that Nassim Taleb came up with, and it's the concept of anti-fragility. And right. There's not really that many anti-fragile things, maybe other than the human body that I can think of. And our challenge, I think, as compliance folks, to your point, is to build some anti-fragility into our policies that are slated on common sense, that understand the human element is critical in this, because at some level, all we're talking about is persuasion. We need someone to act in a different way and comply with this. All persuasion and sales is kind of a compliance game in and of itself. And I think if we can turn our light bulb on around that aspect of this thing, which many times is, a label that we use on people that just keep hitting up our inbox to give us a demo for some software we don't want, we can understand that like this is all persuasion. Then when we go to the regulators, we know that spice needs to be in our dish if that's going to land over there. We need to understand that like that persuasion spice also needs to be in our dish when we serve it up to this other department that we're trying to influence and work with and collaborate on to build that sort of future, what did you call it? Future-proof, these flexible structures that, to your point, the worst thing you see is you look at some of these policies and you can very, very easily, they're like rings on a tree. You can tell like, okay, this is after Me Too, appended to the bottom. Oh, this right. After the BLM stuff, okay, there's something about diversity appended to the bottom. It's not this comprehensive, flexible, common sense, human-based you know, policy that actually directs behavior, it just turns into a freaking scroll, which is insane.
Right. And I think, you know, if you look at when things go wrong in organizations, the first question that's always asked is whose fault was it?
Yep.
Which is a terrible way to start this whole process off, because it starts from, back to your point, it starts from the premise of the policy cannot be wrong, right? The rules, and I ask who it is first because I want someone to shoot, and I won't start from the premise of what might have helped facilitate that piece. That is not to say that if you have someone that is willfully breaking rules, that they don't get sort of dealt with in the right way, but your start point needs to be, actually, we might have got this wrong. And maybe you haven't, but that's fine. But at least allow that particular piece in. And I'm struck by, you know, if you want a really good example of a company that I think has thought this through properly, is Netflix. And they have a very simple approach to pieces, which started out ages ago. And they're kind of like, what has irritated us about companies we've worked in before? And the answer was bureaucracy and stupid. And so what they did is they created a very simple thing, which is this culture of freedom and responsibility. And so you can have freedoms, but there's responsibilities that go with that. And what I really like about it, and this for me is the key piece, is that they split the world into things that are irrevocable. So irrevocable errors and revocable things, right? So if I can deal with it, if something happens and I can deal with it afterwards, it's not a major thing. That's one thing. If I have something like customer credit card details are exposed, or I have bullying, sexism, harassment, all that kind of stuff, then that's irrevocable. So I make a very clear thing around things that, you know, I really don't want to ever have happen, and we've got to build a strong defense around those. And then you have other stuff where you go, I don't want it to happen, but look, if it does happen, then it's less severe and we can at least claw it back. And I think many organizations see, you know, the policy manual is a secure thing where none of these things can ever be allowed to happen. And the realist, people are going to screw stuff up and they're going to make mistakes. And what you need to do, I think, is to guide them into the sorts of mistakes that it's okay to make. The kind of mistakes you can learn from, where it's a minor blip of something, and you know, them learning from that minor mistake stops a really big thing from happening. But often it's not thought of in those terms at all. As you say, it's, you know, back to the adding things into the document. That's not thinking about it from the end user perspective. That's thinking about how have you covered your backside, because we'll just add another thing in. And I love this idea that you know, when you look at sort of behavior codes and or regulations come down, it's people get trained in regulations. So banking are really good at this, where the new regulation comes like Dodd-Frank or something, right? And you get training on that particular thing. Now, that makes perfect sense from an organizational perspective. It's terrible from the individual's perspective because they don't live in a Dodd-Frank or Regulation X world. Right. Regulation X sits alongside a whole load of other things. And at no point are they going out in the world going, I'm now in a moment where this is the only thing that's relevant. They have to put it alongside the other things. And so if you're training them and the training is badged as this thing, and you're talking about the genesis of the regulation, and you know, let's test you on the details of the regulation, that's really unhelpful, because in the same way that we, you know, we go to school and we get taught history and we get taught physics and we get taught geography, as if those things existed separately. They right. don't, right? All of those things are interrelated. Every single moment of our lives, we are partly experiencing a bit of all those individual subjects. Yes. And we should think about that and say that we should be delivering stuff to people in a manner that speaks to the reality of their lives, and recognize that they're gonna screw some stuff up, that they're tired, that they get things wrong. So stop them doing the really stupid things and the really bad things, but allow a little bit of latitude around the stuff that really doesn't matter quite so much, because that's the world that we all live in. We know that if we, you know, there's certain items in my house that if I break them, it doesn't matter. There's other things where I never want to break them because it's criminally expensive or embarrassing or whatever. And we don't think about that calibration. That's not human.
I just feel like we could keep talking for an hour, man. I just, I love your whole ethos. I love your approach to this thing. I think that this compliance 3.0, which is this new mode we're stepping into, we're going to have a lot more people turn these light bulbs on that you're talking about, that can incorporate this human element, that understand the three-dimensionality of these two-dimensional policies that we're putting into practice, and that frankly, our entire world is gray. There's very few things, to your point, that are this black and white. And since we live in the gray, we need to be focused on providing guidance to the human beings who are making decisions every day, if we're ever going to crowdsource risk in a meaningful way. If the name of our game is just, to your point, covering our backside, having a defensible policy, then we're never going to get that magic of actual crowdsourcing the risk, because we're never actually treating the people who are doing the stuff like human beings, and we're just missing a ton of value. So I love what you're doing. I love your approach. how can people find you and get in touch with you and learn more about your thought leadership in this area?
Awesome. So lots of different ways. Human-risk.com is my website. At Human Risk Blog is my Twitter feed where I post things that are kind of behavioral science and compliance related. I have a podcast and a newsletter that cover these topics as well. But all of those details you'll find at human-risk.com. And connect with me on LinkedIn. Right? I love talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
So please feel free.
You're absolutely a master in this stuff. And I'm just excited to have this conversation because as more and more people start talking about this, those light bulbs are just going to turn on. And I think 10 years from now, our compliance function will be clinking glasses on a yacht somewhere laughing about compliance 2.0 and the how pigeonholed we were and how, you know, we really couldn't affect anything. And I'm excited about it. So thank you so much for joining us. And please reach out to Christian on LinkedIn or some of these other, these other means to get a hold of him that will be down in the show notes. Thank you so much, Christian.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.